From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's hard to imagine it now, of course, but if you were an American settler in the early part of the 19th century, itching to get west, one of the things that could hold you back was the Rocky Mountains, especially if you had a wagon carrying everything you owned. That's why when a natural gateway was discovered, a wide valley in what is now southwestern Wyoming, people flooded into it. Between 1840 and 1870, this was 500,000 of what historian Will Bagley calls ordinary Americans seeking a better life for themselves. Bagley's written a book about this wide valley. It's called South Pass, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about it. Mostly he'll do what he always does, that is, tell stories about some of the West's most colorful characters. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Will Bagley's book is the story of a physically unimpressive wide valley in what is now southwestern Wyoming. It's practically treeless there. In fact, Bagley says silence may be its most striking feature. The builders of the railroads and the highway system have left the South Pass alone, and Bagley says you can still see wagon ruts in places. It's because in the middle part of the 18th century, when white settlers got word of the pass, that there was a way through this daunting Rocky Mountain area, they packed the place as they streamed into the West. If it hadn't been so easy to get here, things could have been different in the West. Native people, for example, could have had more time to stand their ground or establish their rights to the land. And that's why South Pass has played such a crucial role in what the West became. Will Bagley's book is called South Pass, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about it. In many ways, what makes the South Pass remarkable is what's not there.
The Shoshone had a name for it, and if my memory wasn't fading, I'd have used it as the subtitle. It said the Shoshones call it the place where God ran out of mountains. Most of the people who crossed it and anticipated the great moment of leaving behind the Atlantic Ocean and entering the world of the Pacific Ocean expressed how disappointing it was. It wasn't spectacular. It wasn't St. Bernard's Pass in the Alps. But that's what made it work, because between Moriah Pass, which is about 40 miles south of the Canadian border, and Guadalupe Pass, which is about 40 miles north of the Mexican border, South Pass is the only natural gap that you could take a wagon over without great arduous labor. And in fact, it still wasn't an easy trek, but South Pass made a single season migration from the Missouri River to the Pacific coast possible.
How did you come to it? What made you think about this as, because it's the sort of principal character, of course, of the book.
It's like a lot of subjects that I've, in many ways, stumbled into. I got hired to do it. I was hired by the National Park Service and the BLM to, at the start of the project, to just draw a boundary around the South Pass National Monument, which Dwight D. Eisenhower created as one of the first national treasures that deserved to be protected. And because of land use issues and Wyoming politics, no one has ever precisely defined where the South Pass National Historic Landmark is, what its boundaries are. And it's interesting because that was the initial assignment, and that ran into local politics, and the people running the project decided, well, we'll create some national historic sites, but we won't tackle the boundary issue. So it's still undefined. But it is essentially everything you can see from South Pass, and you can still see a lot.
A white man gets credit for the sort of discovering it, I suppose, in some ways. But he got the word from a Shoshone.
A Shoshone told Robert Stewart, this dynamic young Scots fur partner who has sailed around Cape Horn to get to the mouth of the Columbia River at Astoria. He's working for John Jacob Astor. And the Indians in Canada blow up the Tonquin, their supply ship. And the stranded fur traders decide, we better get word back to Astor that we'll need another ship out here. So Stewart volunteers to go back. Some of the Astorians, as they're called, had come west with Wilson Price Hunt in 1811. And Stewart was not one of those men, but he picked a couple of guys who had been out. Hunt misses South Pass and goes through what to the north over Union Pass. But Stewart began picking up from Indians that there was a better, more direct route. And what is fascinating is the area is contested ground between the Absaroka, who are known as the Crow now, who are the dominant power because they've got horses and guns, and the Shoshone, who are really taking a beating at this time. And the Absaroka run off all of Stewart's horses, leave them in pretty dire straits, and they take this immense 400-mile detour, wandering almost all the way up to Jackson Hole to avoid running into these powerful Indians.
Yeah.
And so if Stewart had gone from the Bear River, where he was, straight through on a straight due east course, he would have naturally hit South Pass. Instead, he takes a big detour, and he comes to it from the north, coming down through where Pinedale is today. Everywhere they've been are these enormous Wyoming mountains. And finally, they can see to the east this opening, this gap in the mountains. It's where the Wind River comes to an end, at the Wind River Mountains. And at that point, there's an enormous Indian road through it. And they can tell that probably a couple of hundred Absarokas have been over this road after hunting buffalo on the west side of the pass. And so they again take a big detour to avoid it, wind up in the Continental Basin. And it's a fantastic adventure story. And Indians are at the center of it, and the Indians are the great powers. And the Indians themselves are disputing who's going to control this essential migration and trade route.
You know, what's interesting is that the trail was forgotten for years. Stewart had this diary, a travel memorandum, I think it was called. But that wasn't published for like 100 years after.
Yep.
As you said, Americans became preoccupied with other things.
Well, we were busy losing the War of 1812 because what happened to Fort Astoria at the mouth of the Columbia was the Scotsmen who were running the show realized, we're at war with Great Britain, most powerful navy in the world. So they sell it to their fellow Scots in the Northwest Company. But the War of 1812 was a disaster for the American fur trade, and it pushed the fur trade out of its initial forays up the Missouri River, and nobody had figured out a good model to restart it until 1823-24, when William Henry Ashley, a Missouri politician and militia general, recruits 100 talented young men. And these men become some of the greatest legends of the American West.
Jedediah Smith
Jedediah
was among one of them. And this is where you get a lot of really great stories. He gets attacked by a grizzly bear.
He gets his ear chewed off by a grizzly bear. And his equally talented mountain man, James Clyman, sews it back on. Clyman is a phenomenal character who is, except for John Quincy Adams, the only American I can think of who met both George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Because Clyman's father farmed for Washington, and Abraham Lincoln served in the same company in the Black Hawk War with Clyman after he took a retirement from the fur trade. But those are only two of the characters, Jim Bridger, Thomas Fitzpatrick, Louis Vasquez. It's a long
iconic list. Figures of the West.
Iconic figures, with places named after them, men of... who guide the first wagon trains, men of tremendous influence and legendary stories.
You tell a story, June of 1823, they were attacked by Indians, ambushed, I think is how you put it, and they spent most of their summer avenging their losses.
Mm-hmm. They're attacked in South Dakota, basically. And the model for fur trading had always been to get on the rivers, follow the rivers up, have the Indians do the work, and have the Indians trade for whatever they're interested in. But Ashley loses a flatboat. They have to do this arduous push up the river. And he loses a flatboat in the first year. The second year, they go back and they try again. And the Arickaras attack them and essentially come close to wiping them out. They then get into a military campaign. And by the time the fall comes, Ashley's in perilous financial shape. And they roll the dice and decide to challenge the old river-based model and send men overland. And they will do their own trapping, and they will invent a new way for the American fur trade. And they invent the Rocky Mountain fur trade.
You know, you were mentioning this image of the mountain man, of the fur trapper. And there's this great painting of Jedediah Smith. And this big, massive, full beard. But you point out he was clean-shaven.
He was clean-shaven. And so were most of the mountain men, because they wanted to look like Indians. And Indians didn't have big, bushy beards.
Tell us about Edward Rose. He's another great character.
Edward Rose is one of those characters from American history that defy all the stereotypes. He's what they would call... at the time, a half-breed. And actually, he's a complete mixture of American races. American Indians, American slaves, black Africans, with a touch of white European genes thrown in. And he's become, as many of these young men did, integrated into the... a local Indian culture. In this case, I believe it's the Absaroka, the Crows. And they really like him because he's one bad Indian. And in one of their war party expeditions, he supposedly kills something like five men in one fight all by himself. And the white fur traders were a little leery of his character. But they...
You say he was a valuable ally, but a tricky friend.
Yes, indeed. And this is the guide that takes Jedediah Smith and these legendary fur traders up to the foot of Union Pass, which is what they're really looking for. And in fact, nobody's even got a hint that there is this natural gateway that'd be much easier than Union Pass. But the Indians know all about it. The Absaroka, according to Clyman, take a buffalo skin, put sand on it, and show them visually where there is a gap in the mountains. And the fur traders get up in the middle of winter to the Crow winter camps, and they have to pay for their stay. And Rose extracts most of their trading goods just to pay for the winter. And by February, March, everybody's running out of food, and it's pretty clear to the trappers that they've worn out their welcome, and they need to find this South Pass. And they wind up going over ridges to the Sweetwater River. And they stay camped on the Sweetwater, at the mouth of Sweetwater Canyon, killing mountain sheep until they've killed all the mountain sheep. And then in March, they press on and they find South Pass. And it's still winter, it's still frozen, and Kleiman tells a great story about reaching what was probably the Little Sandy, and it's a frozen river. They've been melting snow to get drinking water, and they start pounding on the ice, and they can't get through it, and they're in despair. And Kleiman takes his pistol, puts it down, and goes, blam! And all of a sudden, water is springing up for them. But and they're in buffalo country now.
So yeah.
It's this combination of place and people and story.
Kleiman tells the story about the Pawnees helping him out. And one of the things he did in exchange for this help was give them his hair.
That's another one of these great stories. Jedediah Smith tells Kleiman he'll rendezvous with him in the fall after they've rediscovered South Pass, and they get mixed up. And Kleiman ends up walking all the way from central Wyoming to the Missouri River.
Like 700 miles.
Almost. 700 miles. And he's in tough shape by the time he gets to the Pawnee, who are on the lower Platte River, pretty close to Missouri. And Kleiman's a survivor, and he manages to persuade them not to kill him. But the deal is he has to give them his hair. And he does, but he winds up walking to Fort Atkinson, and he climbs over a hill. There's the fort. And he looks down and he sees the American flag. He says, there never was an American so happy to see the Stars and Stripes.
You say in the book that rumors about gold being in the area had been around South Pass from the very beginning. There'd been all kinds of rumors. Mm-hmm. But then you mentioned one of the great ironies of the era of America's gold rush was that thousands of people were headed to California for the gold rush, really passed over the place where there was a lot of gold. There was gold, anyway, in South Pass.
Well, there was also a lot of fool's gold.
Right.
And most of the 49ers at the very start of the gold rush don't have a clue about mining or what they're going to have to do to get the gold. But a number of them do notice that there sure seems to be gold nuggets, and generally it's fool's gold, but there is gold, and it's distributed all the way from where South Pass City is, which is just north of the divide, and between Atlantic City and South Pass City, there were mines up until the 1950s.
Wow.
And those deposits would leach out, and some of the gold went down Rock Creek and some went down Willow Creek. And they ran dredging operations on Willow Creek, which becomes a sanctified handcart site, up until the 1930s. But the great irony is that all these gold-crazed Americans walk right over a spot where they could have stopped and had about... It wasn't as easy as pickings as the mother lode in California, but it was still there and accessible. And this goes on until virtually the end of the overland era in 1866-67. Soldiers from Camp Douglas had been prospecting in the area, and they'd picked up a definite sign of gold. But what it takes to ignite a gold rush are several sociological factors, one of which is you've got to beat the Indians. You've got to get the Indians out. You've got to have communications, a road to the place. And you've got to have a lot of greedy, gullible people to fall for it. So in, I think, early 1867.
Yeah, 1867. You're talking about Lewis Robinson now.
Robison.
Robison, yeah.
And there's no end.
Yeah.
But Robison is an old Mormon, early Wyoming settler. He's run Fort Supply, and he was among the guys who ran out Jim Bridger. And they're all real experienced business people. They've been making tens of thousands of dollars running ferries and support structure for the trail. And he shows up in Salt Lake with a couple of companions and about $800 in gold nuggets that he says they took out of a ridge up it, and they won't say where.
Yeah, of course not.
But everybody goes, ooh, it must be up by his ferry. That's right. And so the Union Vedette, the newspaper at Camp Douglas, is warning everybody, saying, wait, don't go rushing off and go up there and fall for this. Wait until it's confirmed, and then you at least know where it is. And nobody listens to it. And before you know it, there are all these people crowding the road up into west central Wyoming. And they're all taking Lewis Robinson's ferry. What do you know?
You have a section heading in the book called The Loneliest Land for a Grave, which is something that comes from Mark Twain. He had come by the South Pass Trail. This was 1861, I think it was. Yep. And he was really taken by the graves that he saw, the animal skeletons there. Talk a little bit about that part, because you mentioned how in the 19th century Americans had these pretty intense feelings about, you know, about death and about burying people. But, you know, when you're on a trail and someone died, you had to do what you had to do.
And it was, for everyone, heartbreaking to have to bury a husband or a wife or a child in the midst of what they called the wilderness.
Yeah.
And because of the nature of 19th century American funeral rites, it was ideally a grave would be a place that you could go to on decoration day and decorate the grave, that you could go to and visit your loved ones. And now you were having to leave behind someone in the middle of no place, a place that was completely alien to anything they'd ever seen. And some of the most moving passages are about this sense of desolation at having to leave someone behind.
You see them in all the narratives, don't you? A lot of the narratives of these of people making the pass is the reference to the graves.
Oh, again and again. And it was my friend Terry Delbaney, who is a great public servant. He's worked for the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management and the National Park Service for a couple of decades. And he is the best material historian with an understanding of the culture and the times and how it was done. And he's one of the reasons I despise clowns like Clive and Bundy, who relentlessly attack people who are doing the people's work. And the people I met when I was doing this project in the BLM, in the Park Service, are among they're model public servants. They are dedicated to preserving and protecting the public good. And to see thugs threatening them on Utah highways with their big guns is disgusting. It really is. And Terry and a couple of our other friends in the BLM created a monument to the unknown immigrant. And it is a grave. And they conducted a ceremony, and they did it in the period dress and the style and gave a sermon and recreated that event, which marks such loss for people. And one of the great Utah stories ties into a woman who died, Dancy.
Yeah, Charlotte Dancy.
Charlotte Dancy. As she was dying, another woman died in the train and in childbirth.
As they were digging the grave.
And we have a diary account which preserves the story for us. Again, it's that sense of loss and desolation. And the sacrifices that that characterized this American adventure enterprise.
So I want to have you read this section in the book where you write about Charlotte Dancy.
Before dawn on September 21st, 1862, Charlotte Rudland Dancy, 33, died, quote, of a miscarriage and general debility while giving birth to her eighth child at a camp a mile east of the Continental Divide. According to her descendants, Dancy told her husband, she could stand her suffering no longer and asked him to pray to God that she might be released and returned to her Maker. The infant lived only long enough to be given the name Joseph. John McAllister, who served as chaplain for the Ansel P. Harmon Company, and a few companions went ahead to dig a grave for the body. We crossed the Pacific Creek and dug the grave on the right of the road. As the men were digging her grave, Captain Harmon rode up and informed us that Carolyn Myers, aged 25, was dead. We widened the grave for both bodies. The Dancy family later, as many families did, they'd go and try to find the grave.
But we're talking about a lot later.
A lot later. And people would do it for generations. They'd go look for where their mother was buried. And this is in the late 30s,
I believe. You mentioned it was during the Great Depression.
And the family looks around and they got their graves everywhere around South Pass. They can't find anything. And they finally, and it's one of the children. Many of these pioneers lived to a great age, but it's one of the children. And they notice there's a shepherd. And he has around his neck a necklace. And the survivor recognizes that's his mother's necklace. And he takes him to where he's dug up the grave and looted the grave and gotten the necklace. And the family makes that a shrine, a permanent shrine. And in the 1950s, President Eisenhower deeded them the gravesite at South Pass.
That's Will Bagley. His book is called South Pass, Gateway to a Continent. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're hearing more stories about the American West from historian Will Bagley. His latest book is about South Pass. It's a broad, treeless valley in southwestern Wyoming, which is the principal, was anyway, the principal gateway west for fur traders and gold miners and settlers. And in this part of the conversation, we talk about the Mormon pioneers who made their way through South Pass.
You mentioned how by the mid-1950s, the South Pass, as you put in the book, lay between the two centers of power on the trail west. You had the federal government, the army post there at Fort Laramie, and then you had the Mormon capital in the Great Salt Lake. But you also, you know, there are really three nations at stake you talk about. Mm-hmm. The Mormon nation, American Republic, and the native peoples. And there's a lot of, and this is a big part of the story, a lot of vying, as you said earlier, for power.
And the Indians are caught between the Mormon power of Brigham Young and they call it two fathers. But one of those fathers is in Washington, D.C., and the other is in Great Salt Lake City. And he is a lot closer and a lot more intimate with their affairs. So this contest, and the chapter is called Conflict and Catastrophe at South Pass, really animates and underlies probably the most dramatic and heartrending story in the whole history of South Pass, which is the Mormon handcart disasters of 1856. I became entangled in the handcart story in 2006 when I went to Casper and the Mormon History Association, and they had a big commemoration of the handcart disasters. And everybody put a happy face on the worst disaster in Overland Trail's history, which killed about 250 people. The whole system killed more than 300 people, but nobody was counting, so we don't have solid numbers. And I felt that I needed to do an article to represent the sacrifices and heroism of the people and the insensitivity and cheapness, the skinflint motives of the great leaders who put this system together, which essentially made people into draft animals. And it led me down the primrose path. I did a long article. I could not believe what I was discovering at every step of the way, that it was a much, much worse and cruel, unnecessarily cruel, and ultimately evil scheme. Now, everybody knows I'm not Brigham Young's biggest fan, but I couldn't believe what I was turning up. And the ultimate scandal in what I learned over the last 8 years, I published an article in 2006 that summarized where I'd gotten, and what I learned was that Brigham Young's main focus in 1856 on the Overland Trail wasn't the handcarts. He doesn't even bother to appoint someone to superintend it. It's all decreed. He describes the design and how to do it and all the particulars, and leaves it up to an undefined group of leaders, mostly missionaries from England, to make it work.
John Taylor takes the role, it seems.
And what he does is he issues orders to Erastus Snow, who is also an apostle, and he's in St. Louis, who should have really been superintending the whole thing. But what's Brigham Young's concern? His steam engine. He tells Erastus Snow to make sure he gets his complete steam engine in every particular, because he'd had Snow buy a steam engine, supposedly prepared to steam around the Great Salt Lake, and they'd hauled it 20 miles from the Missouri River, gone through what's called the cholera camp, which was the second worst disaster in Mormon Overland annals, where my great-great-grandmother died of cholera. And as they're hauling the steam engine through Deer Creek, Isaac Coombs, the company journalist, notes the wolves and coyotes have dug up all the graves. And so they park the steam engine, and Brigham Young is not happy. He wants his steam engine. So he sends back Erastus Snow, and the primary goal is to ship out all this heavy freight that they'd ordered. And there's other freight. There's a threshing machine and some groceries and some glass and some books. And when they, in the spring of 1856, Young sends A.O. Smoot, one of his most talented and fascinating of the overland wagon leaders in the entire annals of Mormon history. And Smoot's a real character. He's got a sense of humor. He's admired by the people he works with. And he is determined to get the assignment that Brigham Young gives him done. And it turns out just be a disaster because oxen and wagons cost a lot more. There's a labor shortage. No, there aren't any Teamsters to help him get this heavy freight all the way to Salt Lake. And besides that, they get caught in the middle of the handcart disaster. They are ahead of the Martin Company and behind the Willie Company when they pull into Fort Bridger. And Smoot writes a letter to Brigham Young, and he says, you know, we never had enough oxen. We never had enough Teamsters. We've been snowed on for the last 6 weeks. I think I'm going to leave the books and the glass and the steam engine and the groceries here and come into town. Well, he gets the train down to the head of Echo Canyon, and there's a courier saying, go back, take resources from the handcart rescuers with the Willie Company and bring in the stuff.
And by stuff, it's not the steam engine as much at this point. It's not the books at this point.
You know, what I do is detective work.
Yeah.
And I'm continually, the best detective asks the best questions. And I was puzzled because that's as far as I got the story in 2009. And then I started going, wait a minute. Smoot had already told him that the steam engine had gotten wet, was rusting up, and the books weren't in very good shape either. And I'm going, why didn't they just leave it at Fort Bridger? The steam engine isn't going anyplace. Well, it wasn't the steam engine. It was the groceries. And what do you think the groceries were? The groceries were the trade goods, the liquor and the tobacco that would go in Brigham Young's three private two-ton wagons. So 6 tons of special stuff for Brigham Young and his family. And he knew that the steam engine probably wouldn't be much worse for wear. But if he left 6 tons of liquor and tobacco at Fort Bridger in November, there wouldn't be anything to pick up in the springtime. But I was astonished that this great, vaunted, worshipped, revered pioneer leader would be so callous about people who were sacrificing so much and suffering intensely. And in the 2 weeks it takes for the Willie Company to get into Salt Lake, 8 people die, aged 8 years old to 64. Now, if he hadn't taken teams and men and wagons from the relief party, could he have saved one of those lives, two of those lives, four of those lives? What he saved was his liquor and tobacco shipment.
You say that Brigham Young wouldn't hear of people blaming him, because that's the big question. Who was to blame for that handcart disaster you were talking about? And you write this, which is pretty harsh, Will Bagley. You say, most Mormons appear ready to throw their own mother under a bus rather than hold accountable the man who conceived, designed, promoted, and finally lied about the handcarts.
Well, that's the way I feel about it. And what is the most telling statement is by John Taylor, who is a man, he's Brigham Young's successor. He was in the Nauvoo or the Carthage jail when Joseph Smith was shot. And he had lead in his leg from that assassination. And who does Brigham Young decide he wants to be the scapegoat? I know, John Taylor. We'll blame it on him. And Taylor had worked hard to try to make this cockamamie system work. And Young writes him this nasty letter. And Taylor gets it and he responds, he says, you know that Joseph Smith charged us with doing whatever the leader tells us to do. And I will do, as you know, I will do anything you tell me to do. But I will not take the blame for this because I would never have put money before people's lives. And that's the last time Brigham Young tries to blame this on John Taylor.
It's historian Will Bagley. His book is called South Pass, Gateway to a Continent. We need to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with historian Will Bagley. We're talking about his book called South Pass. In it, he offers a very critical view of Mormon leader Brigham Young and his role in a handcart tragedy in 1856.
What was it like when the companies finally got here in the valley, when they finally arrived? You mentioned there was no celebration, of course. It was mostly just mourning at that point.
The Martin Company shows up on a Sunday, and they are taken down to where the Beehive House is today, the temple, which is where the old Adobe Tabernacle was there. And to his credit, Young tells people that they're coming in. You folks need to take these people home and feed them and bathe them. And they were in deplorable shape. They were filthy. They were starving. They had frostbitten feet. And a number of these people die within days of getting to Salt Lake, which is one reason it makes it so hard to figure out how many people actually died. And what happens next is... the most severely debilitated, people who've lost both legs, for example, are sent where? They're sent as far away as possible. A number of them wind up in Cedar City, where they'll be out of sight. And guess where the steam engine winds up? Young writes to Isaac Haight, who is the mission president down there, and tells him to come on up and get the steam engine, and he can use it in his ironworks. And the steam engine never works. But the other process of discovery that I found that I thought was so shocking was that all this handcart experiment was framed in gathering the poor, that we're going to save these poor English wage slaves, which is what they were, and give them the means to get them to Zion, where they'll be safe and have a new opportunity. And my ancestors were among these people. They did that. They made these sacrifices, and they benefited from it. But in fact, what it appears the missionaries sent over in 1854 to England, their primary assignment was to recruit cannon fodder, that they are, and a descendant of William Kimball, who becomes a Nauvoo Legion general, gave me a letter that Kimball wrote in 1855 to Colonel George A. Smith, an apostle, in which he talks about recruiting 4,000 sterling soldiers to fight our enemies, white and red. I've been working on these related subjects for a long time, and David Bigler wrote a paragraph in our book on the Mormon Rebellion where he noted that as soon as any of these poor got into Salt Lake who were male, they were enrolled in the Nauvoo Legion, the militia. But to actually have explicit orders given to missionaries to go out and recruit soldiers, I was shocked. I mean, I'm not easily shocked, but this is shocking. And then to have historians cover it up to protect the guys at the top, it bothers me a lot, because these people who made such amazing sacrifices deserve a lot better. And I know that Mormon historians have known everything I've learned because they don't say anything about it. The word handcart appears once in Leonard Arrington's American Moses biography of Brigham Young.
So by the late 1860s, it seems the glory days of the South Pass were coming to an end. It's interesting because you quote Wallace Stegner in your book from his Marking the Sparrow's Fall. He writes that the South Pass is still and peaceful, that modern travel does not go that way. And he writes that there's a lesson there, he says, not only in history but in the fallibility of prophecy based on false premises. What was he getting at there?
People predicted that South Pass would be a national sacred space because it would be the way that the railroad would go and the main highways would follow the railroads. And in fact, Interstate 80 does go through what is really part of Greater South Pass. But the wagon road itself has different requirements than a gasoline road. And so it took the easier, more direct desert route, and it didn't need the grass that people traveling with teams needed. And so it migrated pretty far south. And now South Pass has been preserved by generations of ranching families. And I have the highest regard and respect for what these people have done to preserve a national treasure and what I really do think is a sacred ground in American history. From my sense of what matters today in the American West, part of what matters is that we preserve and protect some of the most beautiful and special places we have. I want my great-great-grandchildren to be able to go out and see what my great-great-grandparents saw when they came west in the 1850s and 60s. And there are still places that have resisted the industrialization that has gone on throughout our lifetimes and is increasing. But some places deserve to be treated with respect and left so that people can get a sense of the natural West. We're now seeing all these cockamamie development schemes, the worst of which right now is happening out beyond Wendover on the Pilot Peak Playa, which is the last stretch. It's the last 10, 12 miles of the Hastings Cutoff of the California Trail. And there are proposals from Canadian mining firms. A few of these speculative ventures are American. They're foreign interests, and they want to strip mine the surface of that salt flat for potash. And a good bit of the Hastings Cutoff has already been strip mined. And you could easily continue that process on the Silver Island side of the Salt Desert. But you could stand at Donner, it's called Donner Pass, ironically, that looks out over this last stretch, and you could still see where the old California Trail went. And when you look out, there's the Stevens Ranch that has been out there for a long time. But that's the only thing that would be different from what the Donner Party would have seen in 1846. And to my mind, we need to save these kinds of places. And South Pass is the poster child for these kinds of places.
Let me ask you this finally. What are you working on now?
Oh, I've got the 16th volume, the concluding volume of Kingdom in the West, my epic documentary history of Mormons, in which Mormons and the people they encountered tell the history themselves. And it will be my enduring contribution to the history of my people, the Mormons. And as I look back on it, I go, what a waste of time.
What do you mean?
I have other passions besides Mormon history. But it does. I've worked with phenomenal people. It contains the best studies of the Utah War and the polygamous passage. Carmen Hardy's volume's fantastic. A great California historian, Ken Owens, did the California Gold Rush. And so it is a contribution, but I'm not sure I'd do it over. And this volume is, the concluding volume is Mormons and Indians. And it is the hardest study and the hardest story I've ever tried to tell. It is a terrible, horrific story, and there's the only bright light in it is that the Indians do survive. They survive being poisoned. They survive being betrayed. They survive being pushed off every water hole and food resource they had, and they do survive. But it's a very, very hard story.
It's Will Bagley. This book is called South Pass, Gateway to a Continent. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.